Chapter 45 of the Autobiography of Lord Alfred Douglas. This Legimus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Chapter 45. I ran plain English for 16 months, at the end of which period the editorship was taken away from me as the result of an ignoble intrigue, which did very little credit to the intelligence of those who engineered it. These people were apparently fatuous enough to imagine that plain English, which was my creation and largely written, as well as closely edited and supervised, by me, could be more successfully carried on with another editor. "Plain English is a splendid paper," said these silly persons, "but we would prefer that it should have another editor." This was just as if they had said, "We like Lord Alfred Douglas's poems very much, but we would rather have them written by someone else." I, in the meanwhile, started another paper of my own, called Plain Speech, which I ran for several months entirely on subscriptions obtained by appealing to the public. When I was pushed out of the editorship of Plain English, I brought out a number of Plain Speech, in which I appealed for funds, and I said plainly that unless I obtained them, the first number of Plain Speech would also be the last. When I left Plain English, I took with me my assistant editor, Herbert Moore Pym, and all the best contributors. I also almost immediately drew over nearly all the subscribers in circulation. At the end of 3 months, my new paper had a circulation of over 2,000. Money came in a wonderful way. In response to my first appeal, I got about £250 in free gifts. After that, Mr. Ernest Brown, a patriotic merchant in the city, with the greatest generosity, sent me £50 a week regularly, right up to the time when I closed down the paper. It cost about £75 a week to run the paper, and the balance required I got easily enough. What stopped the paper in the end was simply that my health broke down, and after a very severe attack of influenza, I was brought almost to death's door, and was incapable of doing another stroke of work for many months. This followed on all the strain of the long fight which was what the editorship of Plain English and Plain Speech entailed. The strain culminated in the trial of my action for damages against the Evening News, which had published a false report of my death, placarded it all over London. I had the curious experience of seeing the placard announcing my death and buying the paper, and, under cover of an obituary notice, grossly libelled me. The trial came on just before Plain Speech expired. I lasted out through the trial and 2 days in the witness box, and then, a few days after the verdict, I collapsed. I was very ill for several weeks. My wife helped to win this case for me by coming to court and sitting with me all through the trial. Her presence and the moral support she gave me to a large extent paralysed the attack on me in reference to her father, which was one of the chief features of the brief prepared by Lewis and Lewis for Douglas Hogg, who was the leader for the Evening News. My answers in cross-examination on this point were of course greatly strengthened by the fact that my wife was supporting me, and that, if necessary, I might have put her into the witness box to prove the truth of what I said about the way her father had treated me. Mr. Justice Horridge was distinctly hostile to me when the case began. My counsel, Mr. Commins Carr, made what very nearly proved the fatal mistake of not putting me into the box directly after he opened his case. I told him over and over again in consultation that I would never win the case unless I went into the witness box, but he and Mr. Bell between them persuaded me, very reluctantly, to let him do the case in his own way. The result was, of course, that Hogg got in a deadly attack on me, painting me as blackly as possible to the jury, and reading out my stolen letters to Wilde and others, while I had to sit and listen to him without replying. At last I told Carr that I could stand it no longer, and that if I did not go into the witness box, we might as well throw up the case. By this time he saw what a frightful mistake he had made, and he asked leave of the judge to let me go into the box in rebuttal. Hogg, of course, strongly opposed this. The judge hesitated, or appeared to hesitate, and I was in agonies, but he finally said, It is entirely in my discretion whether or not I allow him to go into the box now, but on the whole I think that the jury would like to hear him, so I rule that he may go into the box." I was saved. If I had not gone into the box, I was finished forever. For if I had lost this case, and most people thought that I had not 100-to-1 chance of winning it, I could never have got over it. Directly Carr had finished my examination in chief, and Hogg started to cross-examine me, I got in some very strong remarks about George Lewis. The judge said to Hogg, "I am not stopping this witness because I imagine that you would not wish me to do so," as much as to say, "He is cutting his own throat, and it is no business of mine to stop him." I took no notice and went straight on, and my case began to develop. By the end of the day, when the case was adjourned, I had begun to produce an effect with the jury, and the judge was beginning to sit up and take notice. Carr said to me in an agonised voice as I left the court, "For God's sake, be careful." I said, "Don't worry, I have got the jury already, and the judge is beginning to come round." Next day my cross-examination went on all day. Halfway through my cross-examination, the judge came right round to my side, and I had got the jury ever since the first half hour. Thereafter, Mr. Justice Horridge helped me as much as he could. He tried on one occasion to stop Hogg asking me a very awkward question, but before he had time to overrule the question, I whipped out a devastating reply. "Well, you are answered," said the judge to Mr. Hogg, with a smile. Hogg made a bad slip by referring to my book, Oscar Wilde and Myself, and in a minute the judge had the book produced, and told me to read any passages I liked to the jury. "You put it in, you know," he said to the discomfited Hogg. I read several passages with deadly effect. The question of a date arose, and I said, "Well, I can't tell you the exact date, but if you look at Eve and the Serpent, that will settle it." Immediately the judge was on to it. "What is Eve and the Serpent?" he demanded. I told him it was a poem I had published, and Hogg produced it, describing it as "a disgraceful and scurrilous attack on one of the Chancery judges." The judge, meanwhile, was reading it with evident relish. I tried to soften it down by saying, "It was not exactly meant for Mr. Justice Eve. It was just a punning skit on the Chancery courts, based on the fact that one of the judges is called Eve."
"Come, come, Lord Alfred," said the judge. "Do yourself justice. You know you meant it for Mr. Justice Eve."
"Well, I suppose I did," I replied, nothing loath. Then followed the summing up, entirely in my favour. Verdict for plaintiff, damages £1,000, the jury adding the rider about the scandal of my stolen letters being brought up against me again and again in lawsuits, and expressing an opinion that those letters ought now to be returned to me or destroyed. Then, of course, the inevitable notice of appeal. The judge expressed a strong opinion that there were no grounds of appeal, but allowed the appeal to be entered, adding, however, that it must be on condition that the damages were paid into court by next day. I shook hands with Carr and thanked him for what he had done. He said, very generously and modestly, "It was nothing to do with me. You won the case yourself in the witness box." Then followed the reports in the papers, with most of the stuff favourable to me hacked out as usual. But even the unfairness of the press could not spoil my triumph. The appeal was dropped, and I cashed in my £1,000. The Evening News, of course, had to pay all the costs, which must have run to a big amount. It relieved its feelings by sacking Matchin, the author of the obituary notice. I ought also to say that I was greatly helped in this action by the kind and generous support I got from the late Dr. Byers Moir, my family doctor, and from the late Monsignor Bickerstaff Drew and the Catholic Bishop of Clifton, who all voluntarily came and gave evidence for me as to my character. No doubt their evidence produced a great effect on the jury. Also, owing to the kindness and charity of Sister Mary Vincent of the Convent of Mercy at Hull, I not only had the prayers of her community, but those of 2,000 schoolchildren every day for many weeks, right up to and during the trial. End of chapter 45.